have shut up and surrendered the floor if Fisher walked into the bar. But no matter where he roamed, Fisher kept circling back home to his greatest passion, the bewitching girl next door, the Copper Canyons. During one expedition into the Barrancas, Fisher and his fiancée, Kitty Williams, became friends with Patrocinio Lopez, a young Tarahumara man who'd wandered into the modern world when a new logging road pushed into his homeland. Patrocinio was Hollywood handsome and musically gifted on the two-string Tarahumara chabareque, and so agreeable to working with the bearded devils that the Chihuahua Tourism Department adopted him as the face for the Copper Canyon Express, a luxury vintage train that makes whistle stops along the rim of the Barrancas and allows tourists and air-conditioned rail cars to be served by bow-tied waiters while peering at the savage country below. Patrocinio's job was to pose for posters with a violin he'd carved by hand, a handicraft legacy from the Spanish slave days, as if to suggest that the life of the Tarahumara down yonder was all hunky guys and fiddle music. Rick and Kitty asked Patrocinio if he could take them to a raraji party, the ancient Tarahumara ball race. "Maybe," Patrocinio replied, before demonstrating that he'd adopted the modern world as much as it had adopted him, "if you're willing to pay." He made Rick and Kitty an offer. He'd roust some runners if they'd pony up food for his entire village. Deal? Deal. Rick and Kitty delivered the chow, and Patrocinio delivered one hell of a race. When Rick and Kitty arrived at the village, they didn't find some rinky-dink fun run awaiting them. Instead, 34 Tarahumara men were stripping down to breechcloths and sandals, getting pre-race rubdowns from medicine men, and slamming back last-minute cups of isquiate. At the bark of the village elder, they were off, charging down the dirt trail in a 60-mile, no-mercy, dawn-to-dusk, semi-controlled stampede, flowing past Rick and Kitty with the speed and near-telepathic precision of migrating sparrows. Yow! Now that's running! Kitty, a seasoned ultra-runner herself, was enthralled. She'd grown up watching her father, Ed Williams, turn himself into an unstoppable mountain racer despite living along the lowland banks of the Mississippi. Testament to Ed's toughness was the fact that of all the races in the world, his favorite was one of the scariest, the notorious Leadville Trail 100, a 100-mile ultramarathon held in Colorado, which he'd finished 12 times and was still running at age 70. A beautiful marriage was forming in Rick's mind. Patrocinio could get him runners, and future dad-in-law Ed could get him inside juice with a prestigious race. All he had left to do was hit up some charities for corn donations to tempt the Tarahumara, and maybe get a shoe company to put them in something sturdier than those sandals, and Fisher schemed on, clueless that he was fine-tuning a fiasco. Chapter 9. Make friends with pain, and you will never be alone. Ken Klober, Colorado miner and creator of the Leadville Trail 100. The big fat flaw in Rick Fisher's plan was the fact that the Leadville race happens to be held in Leadville. Hunkered in a valley 2 miles up in the Colorado Rockies, Leadville is the highest city in North America, and many days the coldest. The fire company couldn't ring its bell come winter, afraid it would shatter. One look at those peaks had the first settlers shaking in their coonskins. For there, before their unbelieving eyes, loomed the most powerful and forbidding geological phenomenon they had ever seen, recounts Leadville historian Christian Byes. They might as well have been on another planet. It was that remote and threatening to all but the most adventuresome. Of course, things have improved since then. The fire company now uses a horn. Otherwise, well, Leadville is a home for miners, muckers, and mean motherfuckers, says Ken Klober, who was an out-of-work, bronco-busting, Harley-riding, hard-rock miner when he created the Leadville Trail 100 in 1982. Folks who live at 10,000 feet are cut from a different kind of leather. Dog toy tough or not, when Leadville's top physician heard what Ken had in mind, he was outraged. "You cannot let people run 100 miles at this altitude," railed Dr. Robert Woodward. He was so pissed off, he had a finger in Ken's face, which didn't bode well for his finger. If you've seen Ken, with those steel-toed boots on his size 13 stompers and that mug as craggy as the rock he blasted for a living, you figure out pretty quick you don't put a hand near his face unless you're dead drunk or dead serious. Doc Woodward wasn't drunk. "You're going to kill anyone foolish enough to follow you." "Tough shit," Ken shot back. "Maybe killing a few folks will get us back on the map." Shortly before Ken's showdown with Doc Woodward on that cold autumn day in 1982, the Climax molybdenum mine had suddenly shut down, taking with it nearly every paycheck in Leadville. Moly is a mineral used to strengthen steel for battleships and tanks, so once the Cold War fizzled, so did the moly market. Almost overnight, Leadville stopped being a bustling little burg with an old-timey ice cream parlor on its old-timey main street and was transformed into the most desperate, jobless city in North America. 8 out of every 10 workers in Leadville punched the clock at Climax, and the few who didn't depended on the ones who did. Once boasting the highest per capita income in Colorado, it soon found itself the county seat of one of the poorest counties in the state. It couldn't get worse, and then it did. Ken's neighbors were drinking hard, punching their wives, sinking into depression, or fleeing town. A sort of mass psychosis was overwhelming the city, an early stage of civic death. First, people lose the means to stick it out. Then, after the knife fights, arrests, and foreclosure warnings, they lose the desire. People were packing up and leaving by the hundreds, recalls Dr. John Perna, who ran Leadville's emergency room. His ER was as busy as a MASH unit and confronting an ugly new trend of injuries. Instead of job site ankle sprains and smashed fingers, Dr. Perna was amputating toes from drunk miners who'd passed out in the snow and calling the police for wives who'd arrived in the middle of the night with broken cheekbones and scared children. "We were slipping into lethal doldrums," Dr. Perna told me. "Ultimately, we faced the disappearance of the city." So many miners had already left, the last citizens of Leadville couldn't fill the bleachers at a minor league ballpark. Leadville's only hope was tourism, which was no hope at all. What kind of idiot would vacation in a place with 9 months of freezing weather, no slopes worth skiing, and air so thin that breathing counted as a cardio workout? Leadville's backcountry was so brutal that the Army's elite 10th Mountain Division used to train there for alpine combat. Making things worse, Leadville's reputation was as scary as its geography. For decades, it was the wildest city in the Wild West. An absolute death trap, as one chronicler put it, that seemed to take pride in its own depravity. Doc Holliday, the dentist turned gunslinging gambler, used to hang out in the Leadville saloons with his quick-drawn OK Corral buddy Wyatt Earp. Jesse James used to slink through as well, attracted by the stages loaded with gold and excellent hideouts just a lick away in the mountains. Even as late as the 1940s, the 10th Mountain Division commandos were forbidden to set foot in downtown Leadville. They might be fierce enough for the Nazis, but not for the cutthroat gamblers and prostitutes who ruled State Street. Yeah, Leadville was a tough place, Ken knew. Full of tough men, and even tougher women, and damn. God damn. That was it. If all Leadville had left to sell was grit, then step right up for your hot grits. Ken had heard about this guy in California, a long-haired mountain man named Gordy Ainslay, whose mare went lame right before the world's premier horse endurance event, the Western States Trail Ride. Gordy decided to race anyway. He showed up at the starting line in sneakers and set out to run all 100 miles through the Sierra Nevada on foot. He slurped water from creeks, got his vitals checked by veterinarians at the medical stops, and beat the 24-hour cutoff for all horses with 17 minutes to spare. Naturally, Gordy wasn't the only lunatic in California, so the next year, another runner crashed the horse race, and another the year after that, Until, by 1977, the horses were crowded out, and Western States became the world's first 100-mile foot race. Ken had never even run a marathon himself, but if some California hippie could go 100 miles, how hard could it be? Besides, a normal race wouldn't cut it. If Leadville was going to survive, it needed an event with serious holy shit power, something to set it apart from all the identical ho-hum, done-one, done-em-all 26.2-milers out there. So instead of a marathon, Ken created a monster. To get a sense of what he came up with, try running the Boston Marathon 2 times in a row with a sock stuffed in your mouth and then hike to the top of Pike's Peak. Done? Great. Now, do it all again, this time with your eyes closed. That's pretty much what the Leadville Trail 100 boils down to. Nearly 4 full marathons, half of them in the dark, with twin 2,600-foot climbs smack in the middle. Leadville's starting line is twice as high as the altitude where planes pressurize their cabins, and from there, you only go up. The hospital does make a lot of money off us. Ken Klober happily agrees today, 25 years after the inaugural race and his showdown with Doc Woodward. It's the only weekend when all the beds in the hotels and the emergency room are full at the same time. Ken should know. He's run every Leadville race, despite having been hospitalized with hypothermia during his first attempt. Leadville racers routinely fall off bluffs, break ankles, suffer overexposure, get weird heart arrhythmias and altitude sickness. Fingers crossed, Leadville has yet to polish anyone off, probably because it beats most runners into submission before they collapse. Dean Karnassus, the self-styled ultra-marathon man, couldn't finish it the first 2 times he tried. After watching him drop out twice, the Leadville folks gave him their own nickname, Ofer. Ofer 1, Ofer 2. Less than half the field makes it to the finish every year. Not surprisingly, an event with more flameouts than finishers tends to attract a rare breed of athlete. For 5 years, Leadville's reigning champion was Steve Peterson, a member of a Colorado higher consciousness called Divine Madness, which seeks nirvana through sex parties, extreme trail running, and affordable house cleaning. One Leadville legend is Marshall Ulrich, an affable dog food tycoon who perked up his times by having his toenails surgically removed. "They kept falling off anyway," Marshall said. When Ken met Aaron Ralston, the rock climber who sawed off his own hand with the chipped blade of a multi-tool after getting pinned by a boulder, Ken made an astonishing offer. If Aaron ever wanted to run Leadville, he wouldn't have to pay. Ken's invitation stunned everyone who heard about it. The defending champ has to pay his way back into the race. Heroic Grandmaster Ed Williams still has to pay. Ken has to pay. But Aaron got a free ride. And why? "He's the essence of Leadville," Ken said. "We've got a motto here. You're tougher than you think you are, and you can do more than you think you can. Guy like Aaron, he shows the rest of us what we can do if we dig deep." You might think poor Aaron had already suffered enough, but little more than a year after his accident, he took Ken up on the offer. New prosthetics swinging by his side, Aaron made it to the finish under the 30-hour cutoff and went home with a silver belt buckle, thereby stating better than Ken ever could what it takes to toe the line at Leadville. You don't have to be fast, but you'd better be fearless. Chapter 10. Perfect! Leadville was exactly the kind of wild rock'em sock'em thrill show Rick Fisher was looking for. As usual, he was out to make a big splash, and a carnival like Leadville was just the ticket. You telling him that ESPN wouldn't jump at the chance for footage of good-looking guys in skirts smashing records on a mythical man-eater? Hell yeah! So in August 1992, Fisher came roaring back to Patrocinio's village in his big old Chevy Suburban. He'd gotten travel papers from the Mexican Tourism Board and a promised payoff in corn for the racers. Meanwhile, Patrocinio had cajoled five of his fellow villagers to trust this strange, intense Chabochi, whose name got stuck in their mouths. Spanish has no SH sound, so Fisher soon got a taste of sly Tarahumara humor when he heard his new team calling him Pescador, the fisherman. Sure, it was easier to pronounce, but it also nailed his Ahab-ness, the constant hunger to hook a big one that radiated off him like heat waves off a car hood. Whatever. As far as Fisher was concerned, they could call him Dr. Dumbass, as long as they got serious once the race started. The Pescador squeezed his team into the Chevy and hit the gas for Colorado. Just before 4 a.m. on race day, the crowd at the Leadville starting line tried not to stare as five men in skirts struggled with the unfamiliar laces of the black canvas basketball sneakers the Pescador had gotten for them. The Tarahumara shared a last few drags on a black tobacco cigarette, then moved shyly to the very back of the pack as the other 290 ultra-runners chanted, 3, 2, BOOM! Leadville's mayor blasted his big old blunderbuss of a shotgun, and the Tarahumara raced off to show their stuff. For a while. Before they even made it halfway, every one of the Tarahumara runners had dropped out. Damn, Fisher moaned into every ear he could grab. I never should have stuffed them into those sneaks, and no one told them they were allowed to eat at the aid stations. Totally my bad. They'd never seen flashlights before, so they were pointing them straight up like torches. Yeah, checks in the mail. Same old Tarahumara letdown. Same old Tarahumara excuses. Few but the most obsessive track historians know it, but Mexico tried using a pair of Tarahumara runners in the Olympic marathon in both the 1928 Amsterdam Games and the 1968 Mexico City Games. Both times, the Tarahumara finished out of the medals. The excuse those times was that 26.2 miles was too short. The dinky little marathon was over before the Tarahumara got a chance to shift into high gear. Maybe. But if these guys were really such superhuman speedsters, how come they never beat anybody? Nobody cares if you're a great three-point shooter in your backyard. What matters is whether you stick them on game day. And for a century, the Tarahumara had never competed in the outside world without stinking up the joint. Fisher puzzled over it during the long drive back to Mexico, and then the light bulb flashed. Of course. Same reason you can't grab five kids off a Chicago schoolyard and expect to beat the Bulls. Just because you're a Tarahumara runner doesn't mean you're a great Tarahumara runner. Patrocinio had tried to make life easier for Fisher by enlisting runners who lived near the new paved road, figuring they'd be more comfortable around outsiders and easier to gather for the trip. But as the Mexican Olympic Committee should have realized years ago, the easiest Tarahumara to recruit may not be the ones worth recruiting. Let's try again, Patrocinio urged. Fisher's sponsors had donated a pile of corn to Patrocinio's village, and he hated to lose the windfall. This time, he'd open the team to runners from outside his own village. He'd head back into the canyons, and back in time. Team Tarahumara was going old school. Yep, old pretty much nailed it. Ken was none too impressed with the new band of Tarahumara who showed up at the next Leadville. The team captain looked like a Keebler elf who'd taken early retirement in Miami Beach. He was a short, 55-year-old grandfather in a blue robe with flashy pink flowers, topped off by a happy-go-lucky grin, a pink scarf, and a wool cap yanked down over his ears. Another guy had to be in his 40s, and the two scared kids behind him looked young enough to be his sons. The whole operation was even worse equipped than last year's. No sooner had Team Tarahumara arrived than they disappeared into the town dump, emerging with strips of tire rubber that they began fashioning into sandals. No chafing black Chuckies this time around. Seconds before the race was about to begin, the Tarahumara vanished. Same eye of the tiger as last year, Ken thought dismissively. Just as before, the timid Tarahumara had hidden themselves at the very rear of the pack. At the blast of the shotgun, they trotted off in last place. And in last place they remained, ignored and inconsequential, until mile 40, when Victoriano Churo, the Keebler look-alike with a taste for pastels, and Cerildo Chacarito, the 40-something goat farmer, began quietly, almost nonchalantly, pitter-pattering their way along the edges of the trail, picking off a few runners at a time as they began the 3-mile mountain climb to Hope Pass. Manuel Luna caught up and locked in beside them, the three elders leading the younger Tarahumara like a wolf pack on the hunt. "Hee-yah!" Ken whooped and hollered like a bull rider when he saw the Tarahumara heading back toward him after the 50-mile turnaround. Something strange was going on. Ken could tell by the weird look on their faces. He'd seen every single Leadville runner for the past decade, and not one of them had ever looked so freakishly normal.
10 straight hours of mountain running will either knock you on your ass or plant its flag on your face. No exceptions.
Even the best ultra runners by this point are heads down and digging deep, focusing hard on the near impossible task of getting each foot to follow the other. But that old guy, Victoriano, totally cool. Like he just woke up from a nap, scratched his belly, and decided to show the kids how the big boys play this game. By mile 60, the Tarahumara were flying. Leadville has aid stations every 15 miles or so where helpers can resupply their runners with food, dry socks, and flashlight batteries. But the Tarahumara were moving so fast, Rick and Kitty couldn't drive around the mountain fast enough to keep up with them. "They seem to move with the ground," said one awestruck spectator. "Kind of like a cloud or a fog moving across the mountains." This time, the Tarahumara weren't two lonely tribesmen adrift in a sea of Olympians. They weren't five confused villagers in awful canvas sneakers who hadn't run since the road was bulldozed into their village. This time, they were locked into a formation they'd practiced since childhood, with wily old vets up front and eager young bucks pushing from behind. They were sure-footed and sure of themselves. They were the running people. Meanwhile, a rather different endurance contest was taking place a few blocks from the finish line. Every year, Leadville's Sixth Street partiers cowboy up and spend the weekend trying to outlast the runners. They start pounding at the blast of the starting gun and keep downing them until the race officially ends 30 hours later. Between Jaeger and Jell-O shots, they also perform a critical advisory function. Their job is to alert the timers at the finish line by going apeshit the second they spot a runner emerging from the dark. This time, the boozers nearly blew it. At 2 in the morning, old Victoriano and Cerildo came whisking by so quickly and quietly, a fog moving across the mountains, they almost went unnoticed. Victoriano hit the tape first, with Cerildo right behind in second. Manuel Luna, whose new sandals had fallen apart at mile 83 and left his unprotected feet raw and bleeding, still surged back over the rocky trail around Turquoise Lake to finish fifth. The first non-Tarahumara finisher was nearly a full hour behind Victoriano, a distance of roughly 6 miles. The Tarahumara hadn't just gone from last to first. They'd done serious damage to the record book in the process. Victoriano was the oldest winner in race history. 18-year-old Felipe Torres was the youngest finisher. And Team Tarahumara was the only squad to ever grab 3 of the top 5 spots, even though its 2 top finishers had a combined age of nearly 100. It was amazing, a hard-to-amaze participant named Harry Dupree would tell the New York Times. After running Leadville 12 times himself, Dupree thought his days of being surprised by anything in the race were over. Then he watched Victoriano and Cerildo whiz past. Here were these little guys wearing sandals who never actually trained for the race. and they blew away some of the best long-distance runners in the world. Chapter 11. "I told you!" Rick Fisher crowed. He was right about something else, too. Suddenly, everybody wanted a piece of the running people. Fisher promised that Team Tarahumara would be back next year, and that was the magic wand that transformed Leadville from a little-known gruelathon into a major media event. ESPN grabbed broadcast rights. Wide World of Sports aired a "Who Are These Super Jocks?" special. Molson Beer signed on as a Leadville sponsor. Rockport Shoes even became official backers of the only running team in the world that hated running shoes. Reporters from the New York Times, Sports Illustrated, Le Monde, Runner's World, you name it, kept calling Ken with the same question. "Can anyone beat these guys?" "Yep," Ken replied. "Annie can." Ann Trason, the 33-year-old community college science teacher from California. If you said you could spot her in a crowd, you were either her husband or a liar. Ann was sort of short, sort of slender, sort of schlumpy, sort of invisible behind her mousy brown bangs. Sort of what you'd expect, basically, in a community college science teacher. Until someone fired a gun. Watching Ann bolt at the start of a race was like watching a mild-mannered reporter yank off his glasses and sling on a crimson cape. Her chin came up, her hands curled into fists, her hair flowed around her face like a jet stream, the bangs blowing back to reveal glinting brown cougar eyes. In street clothes, Ann is a pinch over 5 feet. In running shorts, she reconfigures to Brazilian model proportions, all lean legs and ballerina straight back and sun-browned belly hard enough to break a bat. Ann had run track in high school but got sick to death of hamstring around and around an artificial oval, as she put it. So she gave it up in college to become a biochemist, which pretty much makes the case for how tedious track was, if periodic tables were more spellbinding. For years, she ran only to keep from going nuts. When her brain got fried from studying, or after she'd graduated and started a demanding research job in San Francisco, Ann would blow out the stress with a quick patter around Golden Gate Park. "I love to run just to feel the wind in my hair," she'd say. She could care less about races. She was just hooked on the joy of busting out of prison. It wasn't long before she began diffusing job stress in advance by jogging the 9 miles to the lab each morning. And once she realized that her legs were fresh again by punch-out time, she began running back home again as well. Oh, and what the heck. As long as she was racking up 18 miles a day during the work week, it was no big deal to unwind on a lazy Saturday with 20 at a pop. Or 25. Or 30. One Saturday, Ann got up early and ran 20 miles. She relaxed over breakfast, then headed back out for 20 more. She had some plumbing chores around the house, so after finishing run number 2, she hauled out her toolbox and got to work. By the end of the day, she was pretty pleased with herself. She'd run 40 miles and taken care of a messy job on her own. So as a reward, she treated herself to another 15 miles. 55 miles in one day. Her friends had to wonder and worry. Did Ann have an eating disorder? An exercise obsession? Was she fleeing some subconscious Freudian demon by literally running away? "My friends would tell me I'm not addicted to crack, I'm addicted to endorphins," Trason would say. And her comeback didn't much put their minds at ease. She liked to tell them that running huge miles in the mountains was very romantic. Gotcha. Grueling, grimy, muddy, bloody, lonely trail running equals moonlight and champagne. "But yeah," Ann insisted, "running was romantic. And no, of course her friends didn't get it, because they'd never broken through. For them, running was a miserable 2 miles motivated solely by size 6 jeans. Get on the scale, get depressed, get your headphones on, and get it over with. But you can't muscle through a 5-hour run that way. You have to relax into it, like easing your body into a hot bath, until it no longer resists the shock and begins to enjoy it. relax enough, and your body becomes so familiar with the cradle-rocking rhythm that you almost forget you're moving. And once you break through to that soft, half-levitating flow, that's when the moonlight and champagne show up. You have to be in tune with your body and know when you can push it and when to back off, Anne would explain. You have to listen closely to the sound of your own breathing. Be aware of how much sweat is beating on your back. Make sure to treat yourself to cool water and a salty snack, and ask yourself, honestly and often, exactly how you feel. What could be more sensual than paying exquisite attention to your own body? Sensual counted as romantic, right? Just goofing around, Anne was logging more miles than many serious marathoners. So by 1985, she figured it was time to see how she stacked up against some real runners. Maybe the L.A. Marathon? Yawn. She might as well be back hamstering around behind the high school if she was going to spend 3 hours circling city blocks. She wanted a race so wild and fun she'd get lost in it, just the way she did with her mountain jaunts. Now this looks interesting, she thought, as she eyed an ad in a local sports magazine. Like Western States, the American River 50-mile endurance run was a horseless horse race, a cross-country ramble over a course previously used for backcountry rough riders. It's hot, hilly, and hazardous. Poison oak flourishes along the trail, racers are warned. You may also encounter horses and rattlesnakes. It is recommended that you yield to both. Sidestep the fangs and hooves, and you've still got a final punch in the face waiting before you finish. After 47 miles of trail running, you hit a 1,000-foot climb for the last 3 miles. So, to recap, Anne's first race would be a double marathon featuring snake bites and skin eruptions under a sizzling sun. Nope, no risk of boredom there. And, no big surprise, Anne's ultramarathon debut started miserably. The thermometer was hitting sauna levels, and she was too raw a rookie to realize that maybe carrying a water bottle on a 108-degree day might be a smart idea. She knew zip about pacing. Was this thing going to take her 7 hours? 10? 13? And even less about trail race tactics. Those guys who walked uphill and flew past her on the descents were really starting to piss her off. Run like a man, goddammit. But once the jitters wore off, she relaxed into her cradle-rocking stride. Her head came up, those bangs blew back, and she started feeling that jungle cat confidence. By the 30-mile mark, dozens of runners were wobbling in the damp heat, feeling as if they were trapped in the middle of a freshly baked muffin. But despite being badly dehydrated, Anne only seemed to get stronger. So strong, in fact, that she beat every other woman in the race and broke the female course record, finishing 2 back-to-back trail marathons in 7 hours and 9 minutes. That shock victory was the beginning of a scorching streak. Anne went on to become the female champion of the Western States 100, the Super Bowl of trail running, 14 times, a record that spans 3 decades and makes Lance Armstrong, with his piddling little 7 Tour de France wins, look like a flash in the pan. And a pampered flash in the pan at that. Lance never pedaled a stroke without a team of experts at his elbow to monitor his caloric intake and transmit microsecond split analyses into his earbud, while Anne only had her husband Carl waiting in the woods with a Timex and half a turkey sandwich. And unlike Lance, who trained and peaked for a single event every year, Anne was a girl gone wild for competition. During one stretch, she averaged an ultramarathon every other month for 4 years. Such a relentless battering should have wasted her, but Anne had the recovery powers of a mutant superhero. She seemed to recharge on the move, getting stronger when she should have been wilting. She got faster with every month and came within a flu shot of a perfect record. She won 20 races over those 4 years, only dropping to second place the time she ran a 60-miler when she should have been on the sofa with Kleenex and cup of soup. Of course, there was a weak spot in her armor. There had to be. Except, no one could ever find it. Anne was like a circus strongman who fights the toughest guy in any town. She won on roads and trails, on smooth tracks and scrabbly mountains, in America, Europe, and Africa. She smashed world records at 50 miles, 100 kilometers, and 100 miles, and set 10 more world bests on both track and road. She qualified for the Olympic marathon trials, ran 6 minutes 44 seconds a mile for 62 miles to win the world ultra title, and then won Western States and Leadville in the same month. But one prize kept slipping out of her fingers. For years, Anne could never win a major ultra outright. She'd beaten every man and woman in the field in plenty of smaller races, but when it came to the top showdowns, at least one man had always beaten her by a few minutes. No more. By 1994, she knew her time had come. Chapter 12. The weirdness started as soon as Rick Fisher's dusty Chevy rolled to a stop outside Leadville Race headquarters and two guys in white wizard capes stepped out.
"Hey!" Ken Clover called as he came outside to greet them. "The speed demons are here."
Ken stuck out his hand and tried to remember the phonetics for welcome that the Spanish teacher over at the high school had taught him.
Bienvenido,
he began. One of the guys in the cape smiled and put out his hand. Suddenly, Fisher shoved his body between them.
"No," Fisher said. "You must not touch them in a controlling way, or you'll pay. In their culture, that's considered criminal assault."
"What the?"
Ken could feel the blood swelling in his head. "You want to see some criminal assault, buddy? Try grabbing my arm again." Fisher sure as hell never had a handshake problem when he was begging Ken to find his guys free housing. So what? Now he's got a winner and a pocket full of Rockport sponsorship money, and everyone's supposed to treat them like royalty? Ken was ready to drive a steel toe up Fisher's tail, but then he thought of something that made him exhale, relax, and chalk it up to nerves. Annie must really be making him edgy, Ken thought, especially the way the media is playing this thing. The news stories had shifted dramatically since Anne confirmed that she'd be at Leadville. Instead of asking whether the Tarahumara would win, they were now wondering whether Rick Fisher's team would be humiliated again. "The Tarahumara consider it shameful to lose to a woman," article after article repeated. It was an irresistible story. The shy science teacher heading bravely into the Rockies to battle the macho Mexican tribesmen and anyone else, male or female, who got between her and the tape in one of the sport's premier events. Of course, there was one way Fisher could ease the media pressure on Team Tarahumara. He could shut up. No one had ever mentioned Tarahumara machismo until Fisher began telling reporters about it. "They don't lose to women," he said, "and they don't plan to start now." It was a fascinating revelation, especially to the Tarahumara, who wouldn't have known what he was talking about. The Tarahumara are actually an extraordinarily egalitarian society. Men are gentle and respectful to women, and are commonly seen toting infants around on the small of their backs, just like their wives. Men and women race separately, that's true, but mostly for logistical reasons. Moms with a passel of youngins to look after aren't free to spend 2 days traipsing across the canyons. They've got to stay close to home, so their races tend to be short. By Tarahumara standards, short clocks in at 40 to 60 miles. Women are still respected as crackerjack runners and often serve as the choqueame, a combination team captain and chief bookie, when the men race. Compared with NFL-revering American guys, Tarahumara men are Lilith Fair fans. Fisher had already been embarrassed once when his entire team had crapped out. Now, thanks to his own mistake, he found himself in the spotlight of a nationally televised battle of the sexes that, quite likely, he was going to lose. Anne's best time at Leadville 2 years before was only 30 minutes behind Victoriano's 20 hours and 3 minutes, and she'd improved phenomenally since then. Look at Western States. She'd gotten 90 minutes faster in the space of just 1 year. There was no telling what she'd do when she came roaring into Leadville with a score to settle. Plus, Anne was holding all the aces. Victoriano and Cyril, though, weren't coming back this year. They had corn to plant and had no time for another fun run. So Fisher had lost his two best racers. Anne had won Leadville twice before. So unlike whatever newcomers Fisher had drafted, she had the huge advantage of knowing every bewildering twist in the trail. Miss one marker at Leadville, and you could wander in the dark for miles before getting back on course. Anne also acclimated effortlessly to high altitude, and knew better than anyone alive how to analyze and attack the logistical problems of a 100-mile foot race. At its essence, an ultra is a binary equation made up of hundreds of yes-no questions. Eat now or wait? Bomb down this hill or throttle back and save the quads for the flats? Find out what is itching in your sock or push on? Extreme distance magnifies every problem. A blister becomes a blood-soaked sock. A declined power bar becomes a woozy inability to follow trail markers. So all it takes is one wrong answer to ruin a race. But not for honor student Anne. When it came to ultras, she always aced her quizzes. In short, thumbs up to the Tara Umara for being amazing amateurs, but this time they were meeting the top pro in the business. Literally, Anne was now a hired gun backed by Nike money. The Tara Umara had their brief shining moment as Leadville champions. Now they were coming back as underdogs. Which explained the guys in the wizard capes. Desperate to replace his two missing veterans, Fisher had followed Patrocinio up a 9,000-foot climb to the mountaintop village of Choguita. There he found Martimano Cervantes, a 42-year-old master of the ballgame, and his protege, 25-year-old Juan Herrera. Choguita is bitterly cold at night and sun-scorched by day, so even when running, the Choguita Tarahumara protect themselves with fine woolen ponchos that hang nearly to their feet. As they fly down the trail, capes flowing around them, they look like magicians appearing from a puff of smoke. Juan and Martimano were doubtful. They'd never left their village before. And this sounded like a long time alone among the bearded devils. Fisher cut right through their objections. He had cash and was ready to talk turkey. It had been a dry winter and worse spring in the Choguita Highlands, and he knew food supplies were dangerously low. "Come race with us," Fisher promised them, "and I'll give your village 1 ton of corn and a half ton of beans." 50 bags of corn wasn't a lot for a village, but at least it was guaranteed. Maybe if they had some companionship, it would be okay. "We have other runners here who are also very fast," they told Fisher. "Can some of them come?" "No dice," Fisher replied. "Just you two." Secretly, the Pescador was working on a little social engineering scheme. By taking runners from as many different villages as possible, he hoped to pit the Tarahumara against each other. Let them tear after each other, he figured, and win Leadville in the bargain. It was a shrewd plan and totally misguided. If Fisher had known more about Tarahumara culture, he'd have understood that racing doesn't divide villages, it unites them. It's a way for distant tribesmen to tighten the bonds of kinship and buddyhood, and make sure everyone in the canyon is in fine enough fettle to come through in an emergency. Sure, it's competitive, but so is family touch football on Thanksgiving morning. The Tarahumara saw racing as a festival of friendship. Fisher saw a battlefield. Men versus women, village versus village, race director versus race team manager. Within minutes of arriving in Leadville, Fisher had storms brewing on three fronts. And then he really got down to business. "Hey, okay if we take a picture together?" a Leadville runner asked when he spotted the Tarahumara in town before the race. "Sure," Fisher replied. "You got 20 bucks?" "For what?" the startled runner asked. "For crimes against humanity. For the fact that white guys had taken advantage of the Tarahumara and other indigenous people for centuries," Fisher would explain. "And if you don't like it, too bad.
I couldn't care less about the ultra community, Fisher would say. I don't care about white people. I like for the Tarahumara to kick white butt.
White butt?
Must have been a while since Fisher swiveled around for a look at his own behind. And what was he here for anyway? A race or a race war? No one could chat with the Tarahumara or even pat them on the back and say good luck without the pescador forcing his way between them. Even Aunt Trayson found a wall of hostility facing her. Rick kept the Tarahumara unnecessarily secluded, she would later complain. He wouldn't even let us talk to them. The Rockport executives were bewildered. They just launched a trail running shoe, and the whole marketing campaign was based around the Leadville race. The shoe was even named the Leadville Racer. When Rick Fisher called them for sponsorship, keep in mind, he came to us, then Rockport Vice President Tony Post told me. Rockport made it clear that the Tarahumara would be a big part of the promos. Rockport would kick in cash, and in return, the Tarahumara would wear the banana yellow shoes, work the crowd, appear in some ads. Was that cool? Totally, Fisher promised. Then I get to Leadville and meet this strange guy, Tony Post went on. He seemed like an inconsolable hothead. That was the contradiction. Here you had these really gentle people being managed by the worst of American culture. It was like... Post paused to reflect, and in the silence you could almost hear the realization dawning and forming in his mind. It's like he was jealous they were the ones getting all the attention. And so, with battles brewing all around them, the Tarahumara snuffed out their cigarettes and edged in awkwardly beside the other runners in front of Leadville's courthouse, same place they used to hang the horse thieves. Among the hugs and handshakes, the we who are about to die camaraderie shared by the other runners during the final countdown, the Tarahumara looked lonely and alone. Manuel Luna's genial smile disappeared, and his face hardened into oak. Juan Herrera adjusted his Rockport cap and shifted his feet in his new $110 screaming yellow Rockports with a thick hiking boot sole. Marti Mano Cervantes huddled inside his cape in the freezing Rocky Mountain night. Anne Trayson stepped in front of all of them, shook herself loose, and stared into the darkness ahead. Chapter 13. He who loves his body more than dominion over the empire can be given custody of the empire. Lao Tzu, Tao Te Ching. Dr. Joe Vigil, a 65-year-old army of one, warmed his hands around his coffee as he waited for the first flashlight beams to come stabbing toward him through the woods. No other elite coach in the world was anywhere near Leadville, because no other elite coach could give a hoot what was going on at that giant outdoor insane asylum in the Rockies. Self-mutilators, mean mother muckers, or whatever they called themselves, what did they have to do with real running, with Olympic running? As a sport, most track coaches ranked ultras somewhere between competitive eating and recreational S&M. Super, Vigil thought, as he stomped his feet against the chill. Go ahead and sleep and leave the freaks to me. Because he knew the freaks were onto something. The secret to Vigil's success was spelled out right in his name. No other coach was more vigilant about detecting the crucial little details that everyone else missed. He'd been that way his entire competitive life, ever since he was a puny Latino kid trying to play high school football in a conference that didn't have many Latinos, let alone puny ones. Joey Vigil couldn't outmuscle the meat slabs on the other side of the line, so he outscienced them. He studied the tricks of leverage, propulsion, and timing, figuring out ways to position his feet so he popped up from a crouch like a spring-loaded anvil. By the time he graduated from college, the puny Latino kid was a first-team all-conference guard. He then turned to track and used that tireless bloodhound nose to become the greatest distance-running mind America has ever seen. Besides his Ph.D. and two master's degrees, Vigil's pursuit of the lost art of distance running had taken him deep into the Russian outback, high into the mountains of Peru,
and far across Kenya's Rift Valley highlands. He'd wanted to learn why Russian sprinters are forbidden to run a single step in training until they can jump off a 20-foot ladder in their bare feet, and how 60-year-old goat herds at Machu Picchu can possibly scale the Andes on a starvation diet of yogurt and herbs, and how Japanese runners trained by Suzuki-san and Koide-san could mysteriously alchemize slow walking into fast marathons. He tracked down the old masters and picked their brains, vacuuming up their secrets before they disappeared into the grave. His head was a Library of Congress of running lore. Much of it vanished from every place on the planet except his memory. His research paid off sensationally. At his alma mater, Adams State College in Alamosa, Colorado, Vigil took over the dying cross-country program and engineered it into an absolute terror. Adams State Harriers won 26 national titles in 33 years, including the most awe-inspiring show of strength ever displayed in a national championship race. In 1992, Vigil's runners took the first five places in the NCAA Division II championship meet, scoring the only shutout ever achieved at a national championship. Vigil also guided Pat Porter to 8 USA cross-country titles, twice as many as Olympic marathon gold medalist Frank Shorter, 4 times as many as silver medalist Meb Keflezighi, and was named College National Coach of the Year a record 14 times. In 1988, Vigil was appointed the distance coach for American runners heading to the Seoul Olympics. And that explained why, at that moment, old Joe Vigil was the only coach in America shivering in a freezing forest at 4 in the morning, waiting for a glimpse of a community college science teacher and 7 men in dresses. See, nothing about ultra-running added up, and when Vigil couldn't do the math, he knew he was missing something big. Take this equation. How come nearly all the women finish Leadville and fewer than half the men do? Every year, more than 90% of the female runners come home with a buckle, while 50% of the men come up with an excuse. Not even Ken Klober can explain the sky-high female finishing rate, but he can damn well exploit it. "All my pacers are women," Klober says. "They get the job done." Or try this word problem. Subtract the Tarawamara from last year's race, and what do you get? Answer: a woman lunging for the tape. In all the hubbub over the Tarawamara, few besides Vigil paid much attention to the remarkable fact that Christine Gibbons was just nosed out for third place. If Rick Fisher's van had blown a fan belt in Arizona, a woman would have been 31 seconds from winning the whole show. How was that possible? No woman ranked among the top 50 in the world in the mile. The female world record for the mile, 4 minutes 12 seconds, was achieved a century ago by men and rather routinely now by high school boys. A woman might sneak into the top 20 in a marathon. In 2003, Paula Radcliffe's world best 2 hours 15 minutes and 25 seconds was just 10 minutes off Paul Turgot's 2 hours 4 minutes and 55 second men's record. But in ultras, women were taking home the hardware. Why, Vigil wondered, did the gap between male and female champions get smaller as the race got longer? Shouldn't it be the other way around? Ultra running seemed to be an alternative universe where none of planet Earth's rules applied. Women were stronger than men. Old men were stronger than youngsters. Stone Age guys in sandals were stronger than everybody. And the mileage, the sheer stress on their legs, was off the charts. Running 100 miles a week was supposed to be a straight shot to a stress injury, yet the ultra freaks were doing 100 miles in a day. Some of them were doing double that every week in training and still not getting hurt. Was ultra running self-selective? Vigil wondered. Did it attract only runners with unbreakable bodies? Or had ultra runners discovered the secret to mega mileage? So Joe Vigil had hauled himself stiffly out of bed, tossed a thermos of coffee in his car, and driven through the night to watch the body geniuses do their thing. The best ultra runners in the world, he suspected, were on the verge of rediscovering secrets that the Tarawamara had never forgotten. Vigil's theory had brought him to the brink of a very important decision, one that would change his life and, he hoped, millions of others. He just needed to see the Tarahumara in person to verify one thing. It wasn't their speed. He probably knew more about their legs than they did. What Vigil was dying for was a look inside their heads. Suddenly, he caught his breath. Something had just come floating out of the trees, something that looked like ghosts or magicians appearing from a puff of smoke. Right from the gun, Team Tarahumara caught everyone by surprise. Instead of hanging back as they had the last 2 years, they surged in a pack, hopping up on the 6th Street sidewalk to patter around the crowd and take command of the front-running positions. They were moving out fast, much too fast, it seemed, thought Don Cardong, the 1976 Olympic marathoner and veteran Runner's World writer watching from the sidelines. Last year, Victoriano had shown shrewd restraint by steadily climbing along from last to first, gradually getting faster as he got closer to the finish line. That's how you run 100 miles. But Manuel Luna had spent a year reflecting on gringo-style racing, and he'd done a nice job of briefing his new teammates. The course is wide open under the streetlights, he told them, then suddenly funnels onto a dark single-track trail as it enters the woods. If you're not up front, you hit a solid wall of bodies as runners pause to fumble with flashlights and then caterpillar along in single file. Better to move out early and avoid the jam-up, Luna advised them, then ease back later. Despite the dangerous pace, Johnny Sandoval, of nearby Gypsum, Colorado, stuck tight with Martimano Cervantes and Juan Herrera. Let everyone go nuts over Anne and the Tarahumara, he thought, while I stealth myself to a trophy. After finishing ninth the previous year in 21 hours 45 minutes, Sandoval had the best training year of his life. Quietly, he'd been coming to Leadville throughout the summer, running each segment of the course over and over until he'd memorized every twist, quirk, and creek crossing. A 19-hour run should win it, Sandoval figured, and he was ready to run one. Ann Trason had expected to be in front, but an 8-minute mile right out of the box was just nuts. So she contented herself with staying within sight of Team Tarahumara's bobbing flashlights as they entered the woods around Turquoise Lake, confident she'd reel them in soon enough. The trail ahead was dark and knotted with rocks and roots, and that played to one of Anne's peculiar strengths. She absolutely loved night runs. Even back in college, midnight was her favorite time to grab a flashlight and a friend and trot through the silent campus, the world reduced to glitters and sparkles in a tiny orb of light. If anyone could make up time running blindly on a treacherous trail, it was Anne. But by the first aid station, Sandoval and the Tarahumara had opened a good half-mile lead. Sandoval checked in, got his split, about an hour 55 minutes for 13.5 miles, and shot right back on the trail. The Tarahumara, however, veered into the parking lot and ran over to Rick Fisher's van. They began kicking off their yellow rock ports like they were crawling with fire ants. Rick and Kitty, as planned, were already standing by with their huaraches. So much for product endorsement. The Tarahumara knelt, looping the leather thong around and around their ankles and high up on their calves, adjusting the tautness as carefully as you'd tune a guitar string. It's a fine art, custom-fitting a strip of rubber to the bottom of your foot with a single lash of leather so it doesn't shift or flop for 87 miles of gritty, rocky trail. Then they were up and gone, hard on Johnny Sandoval's heels. By the time Ann Trason arrived at the aid station, Martimano Cervantes and Juan Herrera were out of sight. Sick pace, Sandoval thought, as he shot a glance over his shoulder. Anyone tell these guys it had been raining here for the past 2 weeks? Sandoval knew they were heading straight into a world of slop around the Twin Lakes marshes and down the muddy back end of Hope Pass. The Arkansas River would be a roaring mess. They'd have to haul themselves hand over hand along a safety rope to cross, and then claw their way 2,000 feet to the top of Hope Pass, then spin around and do the same again coming home. Okay, this is suicide, Sandoval decided after he came through mile 23.5 in 3 hours and 20 minutes. I'll save my strength and cream those guys when their tires go flat. He let Martin Manos Cervantes and Juan Herrera go, and almost immediately he was passed by Ann Trason.